Episode 38 with Bodhi Paksha.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Sikar Rode, and this podcast is all about meditation, mindfulness, why we do it, and how we bring our practice and the fruits of our practice into our daily lives. And there are lots of different ways to have a practice, a meditation or mindfulness practice. And in this podcast, I talk with lots of different people, getting lots of different views and perspectives on why they meditate and what kinds of benefits they see and how they bring that into their daily lives. The following interview is with Bodhi Paksha, an accomplished teacher, published author, and founder of the popular Wild Mind website. Bodhi Paksha has been meditating and practicing Buddhism since 1982. He was ordained into the Triratna Buddhist Order, formerly known as the Western Buddhist Order, in 1993. In addition to his work with Wild Mind, he leads activities at the Arialoka Buddhist Center in New Market, New Hampshire. He's worked with low-income teens, with prisons, and he was also formerly the director of a retreat center in Scotland, as well as the Rocky Mountain Buddhist Center in Missoula, Montana. Bodhi Paksha founded Wild Mind in 2001. His books and audiobooks are about aspects of meditation and Buddhist practice. He's well known for his guided meditation recordings. And as director of Wild Mind and the father of two young children, he understands the challenges of balancing a meditation practice with a busy life, and we discuss that a little bit in our interview here. With his Wild Mind website, he runs online courses that are practical and down to earth. It was a great pleasure to sit down with Bodhi Paksha. Here's the interview. Thank you so much, Bodhi Paksha, for joining me in this podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sikar.
So, how did you get into a path of meditation? How did you, was there some events or series of events or something inside of you that suddenly clicked and you decided you wanted to go on this spiritual journey or this contemplative path?
Well, it was really a confluence of things in my life. I was fairly young when I got interested in meditation. I was in high school, probably about 17 years old, 18 years old. I was interested in finding some kind of religious path. I felt a need for something to bring a sense of meaning and purpose to my life. And I did some exploration of politics as a way of doing that, of left-wing politics. I grew up in an area where the Communist Party was quite strong, and there was something quite idealistic about socialism, which attracted me, although that ultimately turned out to be not something I got too far into. And I'd been an atheist for many years. I'd been an atheist since I was probably about 11 years old, because the concept of God just didn't make any sense to me at all. But I did go back and read the New Testament, and I was very interested in the ethical teachings of the New Testament. But whenever I came across references to Buddhism, and there weren't very many, because this was the 1970s in Scotland, and Buddhism was not very well known there, and there weren't many books around at all. Whenever I did come across references to Buddhism, it kind of made sense. There was something quite rational about it. It didn't require any belief in supernatural beings or anything like that. And at the same time, I went through a bit of a personal crisis, because a lot of my friends happened to leave the area that I was living in and went off to do other things. And I was still in school at this time. And at that age, your friends are really important to you.
Right.
And I just experienced a lot of suffering. I experienced a lot of loneliness and anxiety and a sense of not fitting in with the people that I was left with. I was basically hanging around with a lot of people who didn't like me very much.
Oh.
And I found it difficult to get on with them as well. And so I wanted something. I'd already wanted something that gave my life a sense of meaning and purpose. And I'd already heard something about Buddhism. And the idea of meditation as being a way of finding happiness within yourself was very attractive to me, because the outside world didn't seem at all reliable. And unfortunately, there was no way for me to get to any kind of meditation class. The only meditation classes I'd ever seen advertised were in a town about 30 miles away, which might as well have been on the other side of the world, since mm-hmm. I didn't drive. So it wasn't until I went to university, I was 18 years old at that point, and I went to Glasgow and started seeing posters around for meditation classes. That's when I went along and tried it out. I wouldn't say I was a natural, but again, it made perfect sense to me. The principles of meditation made perfect sense.
Right. And did you, as you started going to these classes, did your sense of what you were looking for change, or did anything in particular start standing out as something that you wanted to delve more deeply into?
Yeah, well, I had some interesting experiences fairly early on. I said it wasn't a natural, but I remember one particular day when I was with a couple of my classmates, and we shared an apartment together, and we were sitting in the car waiting for somebody else to turn up so we could all leave and go home. And I was in a terrible mood. I was in a really, really bad mood. I was very irritable. I tended to be extremely irritable in those days. I was quite, I think in some ways I was quite sensitive, and irritation was my defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found myself getting really annoyed by the conversation that these two girls were having. It just seemed so trivial, so trite. And I caught myself just getting really annoyed. And I remembered this loving kindness practice that I'd been taught. And I just started saying to myself, you know, may I be well. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be free from suffering. And it completely stunned me. But after about 3 or 4 minutes of this, I actually felt really happy.
Wow.
I'd gone from, I mean, this isn't anything, you know, mystical or anything like that. It's just, you know, meditation works.
Yeah, it's pretty radical.
It is. It does actually work. I mean, I find this today as well. I'm actually getting into teaching very short meditations to people these days, often just 3 minutes long. And they, very often, almost everyone reports that they've experienced a change in their level of calmness, the level of well-being as a result of that. The reason, by the way, if I can throw this in, why I'm teaching short meditations is because I'm very interested in getting people to make meditation a part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is that we teach meditation to people, and we make them sit through, you know, 25 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes of a meditation session. And people can get the idea that meditation isn't real meditation. There's no point in doing it unless you're sitting there for 30 or 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go home at the end of a meditation class, and the next day, you know, it's like, okay, I suppose I should meditate. Do I have a spare 30 or 40 minutes? Well, no, of course they don't, because their lives are already very full. They've already got a bunch of habits and a bunch of responsibilities. And because they have this idea that it has to be a full-length meditation or it's not real, they end up not doing it at all. So I try to encourage people to think in terms of, well, just try doing a three-minute meditation. I do a lot of meditations that I time for them and say, look, this is 3 minutes. This is what you can do. I get them to do it standing up. I get them to do it sitting on a chair, just so that they, again, they don't get the idea that you've got to have some kind of, you know, special equipment and, you know, get all set up and light all the candles and that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. That's great. It is really bringing it into daily life. That's where the real fruits are, it seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially regularity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that the folks, since we're kind of talking about these mini meditations, do they do they repeat the meditations until it becomes like part of, because that's kind of what you're talking about, that something kicked in after you had done it a few times so that you were able to activate that, or it activated inside of you in a situation where it was really helpful to de-escalate the inner turmoil.
Yeah. I think it's quite hard for people to start meditating on their own. This is maybe another reason for encouraging people to do shorter meditations, to, because what we're asking people to do is to apply a certain mind which they may not actually have really taken on board yet. I mean, things like being patient with yourself and being kind with yourself and recognizing that it's okay to get distracted. You know, you're not the worst meditator in the world because you sit down and your mind is all over the place.
Right.
And, you know, people bring a lot of quite unhelpful attitudes into the meditation practice, first of all. So it can be very difficult, I think, for people to get a meditation practice established.
Right. And did you find that as you do it online, that kind of influenced the way you're doing these meditations as well? Because some of the folks are, like you were when you were young, in a remote place far away from a meditation center. So maybe, you know, is that part of the reason why you decided you wanted to bring it online to make it accessible to people who were like you at that one time?
That's really interesting. I hadn't made that connection before, but I think that's quite possibly the case. Yeah, I have a very strong, sympathetic, empathetic response to people who are in isolated situations and who find it difficult to get along to meditation classes. And there are a lot of them.
You know, what is it like? Because you've been doing this since 2001, this online.
Yeah, I have been doing it for a long time. Well, I mean, when I said there's a lot of them, I was thinking there's a lot of people in the situation.
Right.
They're living in perhaps, you know, an entire state where there's hardly any meditation centers. I mean, if you're living down in, I don't know, Alabama or something like that, there's probably, you know, not that many centers around, and you may have to, you know, travel 120 miles to get to your nearest center.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're, you know, asking about how many people, you know, I managed to reach through online activities, it's quite difficult to count. I mean, we have a lot of traffic to our website. So I have this, you know, website where people can come, and there are structured guides to meditation. There are, I mean, this is all free stuff. There's recorded guided meditations that they can listen to. And we get something like 150,000 people visiting each month.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and they're all over the world as well. I mean, the last time I looked, using our, you know, the tools that Google kindly provides for you, we had visitors from every country in the world, except for, I think, Western Sahara, which is apparently a country. I'm not sure it's even really exactly a country. I think it's more a disputed area where there's not really a government or anything.
Or maybe not even the internet there.
Quite possibly there's no internet or very limited internet.
Yeah.
Certainly, it seems there's not many people there that meditate. that's the one thing I can say.
Interesting. And just to get back a little bit to your own meditation, because you wrote a couple of books about your diet too. Did that change as a result of meditation in any way?
Yeah, it did, interestingly. To put this in context, when I first got in touch with practicing Buddhists and started meditating, I was at university. I was at the University of Glasgow, and I was training to be a veterinarian, which is something that I had wanted to be for a long, long time. It seemed like a long time then. Probably since I was about 14 or so, that had been my dream. So this is like 4 years of my life, which at that time was a major
long
proportion.
Time, yeah,
a major proportion of my lifetime. And I was in contact with Buddhists, and most of the Buddhists that I knew were vegetarian. And I actually was hanging around with Buddhists a lot. I really enjoyed being with them. I was actually working with a Buddhist company, a Buddhist gardening company, over the summer. during my summer vacation at university. And some of those guys lived with each other, and so I would go around to their house and, you know, and have meals after we'd worked together all day, and then we'd, you know, go to the Buddha Center and we'd do classes and whatnot. So I was eating a lot of vegetarian food, but I was almost militantly anti-vegetarian. Mm-hmm. People would say to me, well, you know, when you're eating meat, you're eating a dead animal. I was thinking, well, of course I know it's a dead animal. You know, I mean, everyone knows that meat's from a dead animal. It didn't affect me. I mean, them saying that to me didn't affect me at all. I was completely, it would just seem normal and natural to eat meat. And then my entire class, my veterinary class, went to a slaughterhouse. Because one of the things that you're trained to do as a veterinarian is meat inspection. There's two aspects to it. There's the welfare of animals before they die, and there's also inspecting carcasses to make sure that they're not diseased,
mm-hmm.
So that, you know, cancer and infections and things don't get into the food supply. So we had to go and learn, you know, how to do these things. And the very first day I went into the slaughterhouse was quite horrifying for me. I mean, first of all, it was the smell of the place. I found it absolutely disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else was having this reaction. And I think it was possibly because I had just, for several months, not been eating much meat. I'd been living on a vegetarian diet because I was hanging around with vegetarians. And I actually had to have a scarf wrapped around my face to try to filter out some of the smell. And then we went through onto the killing floor, and although it was the end of the day, and they'd finished slaughtering animals for the day, there was a pig which had been spotted, which had been quite badly injured, and the animal welfare rules say that the animal has to be killed as quickly as possible. So I saw my first pig being slaughtered, you know, being shot in the head and having its throat cut and bleeding out on the floor. And at that point, the question or the statement, you do realize that meat is a dead animal, it suddenly made sense.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what people were actually talking about then. And I didn't actually make a conscious decision to become a vegetarian. I just went home and I couldn't eat meat. We already had some meat that we'd bought for our meal that evening. And I just looked at it and I realized, no, I can't eat this. And I think it was a combination of, as I mentioned, not having eaten very much meat for a while and hanging out with vegetarians, although their philosophical approach to vegetarianism hadn't really affected me on a conscious level. I think the meditation practice that I'd been doing had perhaps opened me up, because I was the only person out of, I think it was like 40, 45 of us who went there. I was the only one who had this kind of response, who actually, you know, saw an animal being slaughtered and thought, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with this.
Yeah, yeah. So it opened you up in the sense that to the suffering of someone else, kind of like an empathetic response.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I've been doing a combination of mindfulness of breathing and of loving kindness practice for several months at that point. And I think it did open me up in an empathetic way.
Interesting. Yeah, and the other thing I also noticed on your website, you mentioned your children, you see your children as your spiritual teachers. Maybe yeah. Maybe you can explain that a little bit.
Well, okay, so let's say you're a meditation teacher and you go along to your meditation class, and of course you're friendly and you're understanding to everybody. And, you know, even when people are quite difficult, you be patient with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more difficult to maintain that sense of, you know, I'm in public and, you know, I'm in charge of myself and I'm emotionally non-reactive and I'm kind and I'm patient. It's much more difficult to maintain that kind of equanimity when you've got a child who's screaming at you or, you know, having a temper tantrum or really upset about something,
right,
or just doesn't want to do what you want to do, or even when they're sick, you know, when my kids were really young and, you know, I'd have to stay up half the night, you know, holding them upright because they couldn't sleep lying down because they had earache or something like that. it really tests you.
It does, yeah.
In some ways, you know, they push your buttons and they learn how to push your buttons. So, you know, it teaches you to practice patience and kindness on a much deeper level, because when you're doing it, you know, at the meditation class, it's relatively easy to do.
Right. Yeah.
There's always you feel like you're in public and people are watching you and you're on your best behavior, but you can remember to be on your best behavior all the time when you're with your kids, and you don't feel like anyone is watching you when you're on your own with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like at work, people's places of work, you know, it's easier to be nice there too, because you're also getting, you know, you're getting paid to be there and so forth.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah. Although I think sometimes the length of time that people spend with each other at work, leads to that familiarity that breeds contempt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also a very good practice place for sure.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Especially when you're at things like meetings and people disagree with you. It's very easy to get heated and to get stubborn and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of your website, what brought you to develop this site?
How did I get started? How did I get the inspiration for it?
Yeah, and I remembered we kind of we talked a little bit about that already, and then what inspired you to do it. But what kept you going on the website? What made you realize this is something that you wanted to do? I guess full time, right?
Or, you know, it is now. Yeah. It's very full time. I mean, it was a very part time thing for a long time. Well, the idea for the website came to me when I was doing a master's degree at the University of Montana, and I'd had this decision that I wanted to go and study Buddhism at university. I wanted to do a master's in Buddhism, and the reason for that was because being smart can be a bit of a problem sometimes, because it can seem quite easy to get your head around Buddhist teachings. And because you think you understand them, you don't ask yourself the kind of the deeper penetrating questions, like, do I really understand this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, on an experiential level, does this even make sense? You know, are there contradictions in this? You can sometimes find yourself holding contradictory ideas in your head, and you can flip from one to the other without even realizing that you're doing it. I think it's very common to do that. So I wanted to be challenged to think more deeply about the Dharma, about Buddhism. And I was lucky enough to bump into a professor of Buddhist studies who was looking for a teaching assistant. And the teaching assistantship would pay for a master's degree. However, and this was a real stroke of good luck, it wasn't possible to do a pure master's in Buddhism at this particular university. There just weren't enough for credit courses available. So I was going to have to do some kind of interdisciplinary master's and choose two different areas, Buddhism and something else, and focus on both of those areas, but especially on the overlap between them. And I considered various options. I was quite interested at one point in studying Zen Buddhism, and so I thought about studying Japanese, but my advisor pointed out that it would take many, many years to develop enough proficiency in Japanese and Chinese, which I'd also have to learn. I'd have to learn classical Chinese in order to be able to make any use of that. And it occurred to me that one of the things I'd always really loved doing was running businesses. I hadn't really thought of myself as doing that, but when I was in Glasgow and involved in a Dharma center there, I volunteered to run the bookshop. And I loved doing it. I just loved the craft of taking something and making it work well and making it appealing to people and increasing the range of books there and expanding things and building things up. So I loved that. And then I ran a Buddhist center for a number of years. I run a retreat center in the Highlands of Scotland. And when I arrived there, it was a very kind of small scale operation. And I just loved building it up and being able to reach more people and being able to benefit more people. And so I thought, well, maybe I could study Buddhism and business. It seemed like a really intriguing thing to do.
Hmm.
And most people at this point do what you're doing right now and give a little nervous laugh because Buddhism, business, aren't they like complete opposites? But of course, in the Buddha's teaching, there's the Eightfold Path, which is, you know, the core teaching of Buddhism. And one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood. So that's Buddhism and business. It's how to make your work into a practice. So I was studying classes in the business school, and I was studying Buddhism in the philosophy department. And I was trying to think, what am I going to do with this degree? You know, where's it going to go? I need some kind of practical project to make the focal point. And I had various ideas. I had friends who were Buddhists who were running businesses, and I thought of getting involved. In fact, I did get a bit involved with them and looked at whether I might be able to apply the principles that I was learning to their particular businesses. Mm-hmm. Hello, dogs. Yeah. You can hear them in the background. And then it just came to me one day. I don't know quite why, but it just came to me that the internet at that time, and you're talking 2000, this would have been the internet at that time, was not a good place to go if you wanted to learn meditation. There were people who were advertising meditation classes there, but you couldn't really go onto the internet at that particular time and learn how to meditate. And I thought, well, you know, you can... People don't think it unusual to learn meditation from a book. They go out and buy tons of, you know, books about meditation and books about Buddhism. Sure. People don't think it unusual to go out and buy a CD on meditation and learn that way. And I thought, well, you can do all of those things on the internet.
Exactly. Right.
So I thought, okay, let's work on putting together a structured program. And I actually wrote a grant proposal to the Council of Learned Societies and managed to get some grant money, which funded me for a summer to work on writing and recording some materials. And I tried them out in the university, first of all. It was an online course, but just within the university. And then I started the website and opened it up. And that was in 2001, November of 2001.
Wow. It started attracting people to come to it. And how did you change over time to meet their, you know, whatever needs they had? Did you just do it based on whatever feedback you got, or?
Well, things just kind of evolved. Originally my idea was just have a website where people can come and they can learn something about meditation. And, you know, that was it. And trouble is, I was a graduate student and I could barely scrape through a week and feed myself. Never mind set up a website. I had a friend who was a Buddhist who was a fairly successful businessman. And I told him about my idea for this website. And I said, I'd probably need a couple of $100 to get it started. And he said, oh, no problem at all. You know, he had more than that in his wallet at that particular time. And he said, have you actually thought about doing like meditation classes online? Because he knew I was a meditation teacher. And I thought, oh, no, I haven't. He said, well, could you do that? I said, yeah. And I immediately thought about how you could do that. You could have, you know, discussion forum and readings and guided meditations and whatnot. And so, after starting the website, I moved into having online courses. And it turned out that people liked the recordings that I'd done. So I turned some of those into a CD, and the CD did very well. And things just kind of took off from there.
And then did the CDs eventually turn back into downloadable audio, or is that still?
No. Of course, you've got to do downloads these days. So yeah, we've part of the website now is a little online store where you can go and buy CDs and MP3s and things like that. The online courses that I've done have changed. Yeah, quite dramatically. I used to work with a small number of people quite intensively, and I would do, I'd have daily correspondence with them about their practice. And of course, that limits you to a small number of people. I could maybe have 15 or 20 people, mm-hmm. and keep up that kind of daily correspondence. Now we've opened the courses out. They're all by donation. We don't have any fixed charges. We just suggest, you know, if you consider yourself to be in a low income category, then, you know, here's a suggested donation. If you've got, you know, more money, here's another, you know, level of donation. And so, you know, we're getting, you know, on our most recent course, there was about 227 people on the most recent event that I did.
That's great. And you also mentioned Prism. Do they do it the same way? They go to your website and download a course, or
in Prism?
Yeah, I think I read somewhere on your website.
Yeah, no, I for several years I went along to the state prison for men in Concord, New Hampshire, where there was already a meditation group.
So that was in person then?
Established. Yeah, they don't have a lot of internet access in prison for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So, that was actually an incredibly fulfilling thing to do. I really loved it. It was quite frustrating in some ways, but not because of the inmates, but because of the staff, who would often make it, you know, quite difficult. I'd drive an hour there and discover that there was something else planned for the chapel that day, and no one had bothered to call any of the volunteers. And so you'd drive an hour home again. So sometimes it was kind of frustrating, but the amazing thing was that these guys had an incredible depth of practice, because they were living in very difficult circumstances, and the Dharma practice, the meditation practice, was a lifesaver for them. And it was actually inspirational to be with a group of people who were so committed to the practice. It was much more satisfying in many ways than teaching a meditation class in my local Dharma center just down the road, where, you know, in some cases people would come along and meditate for the evening, but that was the only meditation that they did all week.
Yeah, so it's almost like that image of your hair being on fire, and I have a sense that if you're in prison, you're more willing to make a full commitment than if you're, you know, you got lots of distractions and other things you can get into.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the problem became one of time and resources, really. My then wife and I had adopted two children, and she wasn't working anymore because she was staying, she wasn't working full time because she was staying at home to look after the children more. So we had a lot less money, and I just had to be much more careful about how I spent my time. So unfortunately, that was one of the things I had to drop. The group is still meeting, though, that other people stepped in and kept that going. I also went down to a couple of prisons in Massachusetts as well, until I managed to get somebody else to take over.
Wow. Yeah, and you also mentioned you worked with low-income teens at one point, or?
Yeah, that was at the University of New Hampshire. There's a program there. It's actually a federally funded program called Upward Bound. And everyone thinks I'm saying Outward Bound, and it's about camping. Upward rather than outward. And it's a federally funded program that was started in the 1960s. Back in the days when people thought that, back in the days when there was a consensus that helping people from low-income families to get into higher education was a good thing, because you know, it would strengthen the nation, because you're tapping into talent that might otherwise go unrealized. And so, the program aims to help teens from low-income families prepare for college. Well, actually, none of their parents have ever been to college. Often their parents are quite impoverished. Sometimes they have, you know, mental health problems, substance abuse problems, etc. So, you know, they were a great bunch of kids. And I did that for 10 years. I very tentatively started doing some meditation with them. I was basically asked to come in and help teach them study skills and personal development skills. And I was a little hesitant about introducing them to meditation at first, because it's something that's really precious to me. And the thought of taking something very precious and offering it up to a bunch of people who might not appreciate it or might find think it was boring or dull or something like that. That was scary. But I took the risk and I started introducing them to some meditation and found out very quickly it was their favorite thing of everything I was teaching. It was their very favorite thing, and they wanted more of it.
That's great.
So it became a regular thing, and we wouldn't do a huge amount of meditation. It would be a 7 or 8 minute meditation, but we did it in every single class, and they found that very, very beneficial.
Did you notice it changed them as well?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell whether meditation changes people, because I'm getting a bunch of people I don't really know very well, and I'm teaching them to meditate. And by the time I'm getting to know them, they've already been meditating for a few weeks.
Yeah.
So, but a lot of them said that they find it helpful. So
that's great.
I have to go in their reports rather than mine.
Yeah, right. You called the website Wild Mind. Is this something that's, how do you explain Wild Mind in terms of, working with those habit patterns and things like that?
Usually I don't explain it. It's just, it was just a name. It's become, in a way, just a name. At first, I put quite a bit of thought into, how you explain this. And I would explain it in terms of an ecosystem, for example. An ecosystem doesn't have anyone in control of it. There's no one saying, okay, we've got too many insects. Let's send in the birds so they'll eat the insects. There's no one saying, oh, there's a clearing here. Let's plant a few seeds so that some trees grow up. It just all kind of, works perfectly and beautifully. And so meditation can bring about something like that as well. At first, we feel compelled to meddle with our minds. We feel like we always need to be doing something, and actually we do need to do something at first. We need to make some kind of an effort. But with practice, you can get more of a sense that your meditation practice is just happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's just arising within you, and it can happen quite beautifully. There can be no conscious intent to do anything. You're just sitting there. It's like sitting observing a forest and seeing all the life going about its business, doing whatever it does, staying, keeping in balance. And it can be like that with the mind as well, that you're not doing anything but sitting there. And sometimes even when you're not watching, you get the sense that this thing's going on. I've had many times in my meditation practice where I've become mildly distracted and I'm thinking about something. And then I realize, oh, hang on, I've been distracted. Let's go back to noticing what my experience is. And I find that my experience is very different from what it was before I got distracted. Suddenly, now, I'm really happy. And it's really easy to be calm. And my mind feels bright and I feel energized. And it's like while my attention was out of the way, some parts of me were collaborating to produce this beautiful experience for me to come back to. And so, there is a sense in which I'm using this word, wild mind, to suggest something quite expansive. I also tend to use a lot of nature imagery. I think all meditation teachers end up using a lot of nature imagery because it's very evocative. So we talk about sitting like a mountain, and we talk about letting your mind be like water. So you stop stirring the water and you just let it settle down, and you let your water become clear and calm and able to reflect. And you find that as water calms down, you can see into it more easily. And again, with your mind calming down, you can see into that more easily. So there's a lot of nature imagery that tends to come into meditation practice. So again, there's this idea of the wild as being something quite spiritual.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't, these days, I tend not to, I suppose just because I wrote all this stuff and I've left it on the website for years now, and the explanation is still there. But I don't tend to think about it very much, so I have to confess.
Yeah, Yeah, it's really nice to because meditation is a way to let the background, which in a lot of cases folks don't even hear the birds anymore because they're only hearing the foreground, which might be their own mind. Maybe that's one of the reasons why so many people start noticing, you know, nature after they meditate for a while, that the background comes to the foreground.
Yeah, possibly.
So you're also an individual coach, and is that part of the website as well, or is that...
It's something that's available through the website, and it's something that's fairly new for me as well. And as I mentioned, I did quite a bit of coaching in my early days when I first set up online courses. I mean, a lot of what I was doing was coaching people. But through text, corresponding with them on a pretty much daily basis. And that's what I got the idea from, being on a Generation X Dharma Teachers Conference this past summer. And there were a few people there who were coaching and who got a lot out of it. I thought, well, okay, I'll give that a try as well.
Yeah. You mentioned on your website that some folks listening to this might be going, oh, maybe that's a helpful way to have somebody kind of see your back. Cool. You already mentioned your kids, and that's wonderful that folks like us who have families, they watch the back of our neck, you know, the parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily notice or want to notice as much. And as a coach, you kind of do that as well then, right? It's kind of help folks with seeing patterns that they might not themselves recognize as easily.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the big advantages of Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship. That was it's interesting. You look at the Buddhist scriptures and you see places where, you know, the Buddha says, for example, that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
A very strong statement.
Yeah.
And yet there's actually very little in terms of teachings apart from that on spiritual friendship. I can think of a couple of suttas where the Buddha either discusses spiritual friendship or praises spiritual friendship in a kind of a detailed way. But it's not really developed very strongly. But anyway, one of the advantages of spiritual friendship is it helps you to become conscious of things that you're not so conscious of.
Right. That's great. Is there anything else that you would like to tell people that would be listening now that, you know, want to be free from suffering, and maybe some tips or ideas that you have for them with all your experience as somebody who helps people remotely?
Well, there are many things I could say. I mean, the first thing that springs to mind is to find some kind of balance in your meditation practice. Because a lot of people, when they go to learn meditation, take up some kind of mindfulness practice. That's the most common thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're sitting watching your breathing, or you're sitting paying attention to the body, or you're sitting noticing thoughts passing through and letting go of them. And that is all great. It's all wonderful. It's a very good thing to do. It's an excellent practice. But there's a whole other side of practice, which involves working with the heart and developing more kindness and developing more compassion and developing more appreciation. And that is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I am quite wary of in the modern Buddhist world is there's an emphasis on the goal as being having a particular kind of insight. And so people want to have this kind of insight. They want to see through the illusion of self, for example, which mm-hmm. is, of course, a completely valid, perfectly wonderful thing to do. And everyone should have that experience. But the Buddha's ideal of somebody who's awakened was not just somebody who has had that insight and seen through the illusion of a separate permanent self. The Buddha's ideal was of somebody who is like an ideal human being, really. Somebody who is warm and compassionate and kind.
Right.
Somebody who's patient and who is able to, you know, live in a very simple way. So some of those elements tend to get lost in people's practice because they're focusing on, well, I'm going to develop mindfulness, and out of that mindfulness, I'm going to develop insight. But if you're doing that, you're not really aiming at becoming the kind of person that the Buddha was encouraging us to be. And so you're not really aiming at what the Buddha's goal was. So I really encourage people to take up not just mindfulness practice, but to take up some kind of loving kindness or compassion practice as well.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah, I know my teacher's teacher, the way he would put that is he said, well, I'm not interested in your enlightenment experience. I'm interested in the day after. Which, you know, what nice. Are you going to do with that?
Nice. I like it.
Well, this has been wonderful. I really appreciate your time and your kind words. And I hope that folks can check out your website. And if they're interested, you write a lot of blog posts and you have a big Facebook page. And let's see, you have Twitter and anything else.
Yeah. We've got a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, that's most of it. But I would suggest to people that they go and check out our blog. There's a constant stream of articles there. A lot of them are links to news stories about meditation, of which there are a lot these days. So our blog is partly a gigantic database of news stories, which you can search through. Plus, of course, there's articles on practice there. And then there's the free structured guides to meditation that I mentioned. And of course, there's access there to our online events, which, again, as I've mentioned, are all by donation.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Siko. Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Bodhi Paksha. You can find the show notes for this particular episode by going to meditationfreedom.com/38. And as always, leave a comment if you feel so inclined. Just let us know what you think. And if you get a chance, please go to meditationfreedom.com/survey. I wanted to do a quick little survey to make sure that the podcast and the episodes are resonating with you and to see if I can get any other feedback that might help me make the podcast resonate even more and make it more beneficial. So again, that's meditationfreedom.com/survey. Your input is most appreciated. Thank you so much. And I just wanted to end with a couple of quotes. The next two quotes are by Thich Nhat Hanh. A human being is like a television set with millions of channels. We cannot just let one channel dominate us. We have the seed of everything in us, and we have to recover our own sovereignty. And another one by Thich Nhat Hanh. What is evil? It is when the face of God, the face of Buddha within us, has become hidden. To develop the drop of compassion in our own heart is the only effective spiritual response to hatred and violence. That drop of compassion will be the result of calming our anger, looking deeply at the roots of our own violence, deep listening and understanding the suffering of everyone involved in the acts of hatred and violence. And then finally, a quote by Unknown. Peace, it does not mean to be in a place where there is no noise, trouble, or hard work. It means to be in the midst of all those things and still be calm in your heart. Thanks again for listening. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.